Hi, this is John Udell. Joining me for today's podcast is Cricket Liu. He's a DNS expert whose books on that topic have educated all of us, and he's the VP of Architecture at Infoblox. In this conversation, we talked about whether or not it's a good idea to try to extend the DNS to identify humans as well as machines. We also talked about how to identify security vulnerabilities in DNS implementations and how to correct them.
Hi, John.
Hi, Cricket. First of all, thank you for doing this, A, on such short notice, and B, at such an early hour there in Hawaii. I appreciate it.
Oh, we're happy to.
Thanks. Also, I know a lot of people are always thanking you for the excellent work that you've done explaining the DNS system over the years, and I just want to chime in and say the same.
Oh, well, you're quite welcome.
In thinking about what I wanted to discuss with you, I boiled it down to the following question, and there are a couple of different aspects to it. But the basic question is, first of all, should, and second of all, can the DNS system evolve from one which primarily identifies machines to one which is used to also carry information about people?
Oh, well, yeah.
Just to kind of frame this, and then you can dive in and take this in whatever direction that you want. I was looking over the various things I've heard and read and talked to people about over the last 5 years, probably, and one of the things that popped out was an early essay by Clay Shirky. This was kind of in the early P2P buzz era. That's probably dates to 2000 or 2001, back when Tim O'Reilly was having these peer-to-peer summit meetings. I went to a couple of those, and at the time, Clay was pointing out how systems that used what he called protocol-centric and ultimately human-centric addressing, like Napster and ICQ, were in some ways bypassing or sidestepping or supplanting the DNS system. And I thought that was a pretty interesting observation. And I've seen that play out in a couple of ways more recently that I can point to and that a lot of people have talked about and heard about. So one of them is enum, the idea that the DNS can carry a universal or portable telephone number that identifies an individual. And then even more recently, there was a flurry of activity, although it seems to have died down now, but there was a flurry of activity in 2004 around sender authentication schemes for email, including things like SPF, Sender Policy Framework, and the Microsoft Caller ID for email, Yahoo domain keys. And actually, I haven't really sort of followed that stuff closely, but what they all had in common was this notion of using the extensibility of the DNS to add in this class of information, which was really talking about people more than it was talking about machines.
Right. Classic SPF, actually, though, you're authenticating just a sending mail transport agent, not necessarily a person.
True.
But with like DKIM, you're exactly right. With DKIM, you're actually storing key information that can authenticate individuals in their email.
Yeah. The broad question here is, you know, with all of your perspective on the evolution and nature of the DNS, we've seen these various efforts to inject human identity, if you will, into the DNS. And none of them seems to be a resounding success at this point, although they all seem like perfectly plausible and, to me, good ideas. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question. I think one of the first questions that we need to ask, though, is why? You know, why do all these things sort of gravitate towards DNS?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any particular reason for it? And I think that the answer to that is that the DNS is really the only ubiquitous piece of infrastructure we have on the internet that is extensible enough to support these types of applications.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it's necessarily a good fit. It's that it's sort of the only possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And if there were an internet-wide directory service, like an LDAP-based directory service,
mm-hmm.
for example, that would probably be a more natural fit for a lot of these services.
Right.
Right. I mean, DNS is only a naming service. It doesn't support, for example, a lot of the more sophisticated or fuzzier forms of searching that you would normally want to do when looking up information about people.
Right.
But because DNS is sort of the only possible option right now for a lot of these things, I think they tend to gravitate towards DNS. And it's relatively easy to add, for example, a new record type in DNS in order to accommodate SPF. And of course, many of these new applications of DNS use text records.
Well, I was just going to say, this is something that I have found to be fascinating, which is that in principle, well, not just in principle, but in fact, DNS has a formal extensibility mechanism, and yet almost invariably what I see is that people bypass that in favor of what I call scribbling in the margins, which is to say using these text records, which are simply freeform, to add annotations for specific applications. I have at times written about this and suggested that it's saying something interesting, not just about DNS, but about the nature of extensibility in general. And that's a kind of a maybe a tangential, but an interesting question.
That sort of says a great deal about how people feel about the IETF and the process that you have to go through in order to add a new record type. And it's not just that. If you've got a good idea and there's not a lot of debate, you can get new record types through the relevant DNS working group and the IETF.
Yeah.
But then you have to sit around and wait for basically every major vendor to pick up that new record type
Yes.
and support it in their implementation of DNS.
Yes.
And I think that's really what takes... And that's really what takes a long time.
And it's what takes a long time in all such extensibility frameworks, and is probably mm-hmm. an indication of why it is that people do go for the ad hoc approach. But so it's clear that the DNS is there and there's a temptation to leverage it for other things. And it's also clear that it isn't necessarily designed for a variety of things. In fact, the other thing that I turned up when I was researching this call was a talk that Nelson Minar gave. It was also in the same era. It was probably like 2001. And it was on distributed systems topologies. And he looked at a variety of them, including hierarchical and ring and a variety of combinations of those different topologies along dimensions like coherence and manageability and extensibility and so on. And I mean, this was at a point where things like Nutella with these interesting hybrid models were coming up. The checklist here says that the huge point in favor of DNS, apart from the ubiquity that you mentioned, is scalability. And a lot of the other topologies initially didn't have that, but that the emerging hybrids were combining scalability with either more rapid propagation or in some cases more fault tolerance, and in any case a good amount of scalability. So, you know, do you think that, I'm almost tempted to say at this point, that these experiments in injecting stuff into the DNS have just really kind of failed and that we really should look elsewhere? Do you think that that's true?
Well, you know, I don't know, because I would say that enum certainly seems to show a fair amount of promise.
Really?
Well, at least that's the feeling I get. Now, I'm not as closely involved in enum as arguably I should be, but there are lots of people who sort of specialize in enum, and the impression they give me anyway is that the support for enum, particularly among, for example, European organizations, is pretty good.
Yeah, but that's actually why it's interesting to talk to you as a kind of a generalist in this area, because I'm certainly no DNS specialist, never mind an expert in something like enum, but I've certainly been hearing about it for a long time. On the other hand, I've certainly never interacted with, to my knowledge, anything that was enabled by enum, and nor have I run into anyone who's just in ordinary conversation mentioned that they have. So I kind of just don't, you know, I don't see it happening on the ground is what I'm saying.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess there's also the possibility that some of the enum that's been implemented is sort of internal enum, joining together islands of VoIP implementations, for example, so that
right.
one company can have VoIP users who are in the UK call VoIP users who are in the US and vice versa.
But right.
that's certainly possible. And
I think you're 100% right that that's an early and maybe one of the most prevalent use cases.
And of course, it would be very difficult to determine that was actually what was going on if you were borrowing somebody's phone to call someone.
Yeah,
you really wouldn't have any evidence that was what was happening under the hood.
Right. Well, let me turn it around and ask what you think are the shining examples of cases where there have been extensions to the DNS that have worked out well and have become widespread and popular and useful.
Well, the MX record is pretty popular.
Okay. Well, yeah. But, you know.
Besides that, I'd say TSIG is reasonably successful.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, T-Sig is a symmetric authentication mechanism. Basically, it allows one DNS endpoint, whether it's a resolver or a name server, to authenticate DNS messages that it receives from another DNS endpoint.
Okay.
And so it's used, for example, to secure zone transfers.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, no, I've heard about this.
Right, or a secure dynamic update sent from an updater to a name server.
Right.
And it's been pretty successful, I would say. It's not used, I think, quite as widely as I'd like to see it used, because
right.
It's a very handy, lightweight mechanism, but
right.
pretty successful.
But that's also a case of an extension whose purpose is really to sort of consolidate and solidify the operation of the DNS system itself, rather than to extend it into other areas or domains.
Exactly, exactly. So it's sort of an internal infrastructure improvement rather than being one that sort of faces outward.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and maybe that's telling. I mean, maybe because it is quite interesting to me. I mean, these experiments are going on. And so in the case of email authentication, for example, I notice nowadays that you can see, you know, sort of signed headers in mail that comes from Yahoo or mail that comes from Google. So there are, in those cases, fairly broad experiments going on, which do leverage DNS infrastructure to achieve the goals of those systems. You know, but I'm having a really hard time getting a read on what the outcomes of those experiments has been.
And of course, anytime you see that, you're looking at authentication of the sending mail transport agent rather
mm-hmm.
than the sending user.
Yes.
Unless you talk to somebody and they tell you, oh yeah, well I created a key and, you know, the administrator for yahoo.com or google.com published that in DNS, you can pretty well be sure that it's just the MTA that's being authenticated.
That's true, but there are plans at least on the boards for a more human-centric approach. So I guess domain keys in particular has the notion that you can go end to end and ultimately become more specific in what or even who you are identifying, right? And that's kind of, at the moment, it's kind of like, well, we'll get to that after we lay the groundwork, but you have to wonder if we ever will. I don't know. I'm really curious about that. And to flip it around, I guess, would be to ask, what would be sort of the architectural reasons why DNS could be the wrong system to use for something like that? And if you were creating DNS today and you had these kinds of requirements more top of mind than they were originally, would it mean that you would have to have a completely different system, you know, a different topology, a different architecture, or would it just be a change at the margin?
That's a good question. You know, there's a hybrid system now that sort of takes the domain keys approach and the Cisco, what was it called, Internet Identified Mail approach, which is called DKIM, D-K-I-M.
Okay.
And DKIM has basically the features of domain keys and some of the features of this IIM, and it does, as you say, support the authentication of actually, you know, end users sending email across the Internet.
Yeah.
But when I think about that, I think exactly about the sorts of problems that you talked about. You know, if I have to manage a zone that's basically full of keys about individuals, well, first of all, am I the right person to do that?
Yeah.
If I'm the DNS administrator for a company?
Exactly.
That's not the type of data that I'm accustomed to handling.
Yeah.
What about the frequency with which that data might have to change? How am I going to accommodate that? Are people going to have to come to me if they want to regenerate a key pair and publish a new public key? How does that work?
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of interesting challenges there, as there are with enum as well. You talk about enum, and you've got this data in enum that's really sort of personal data, although it's associated with a telephone number and E164 number, and it maps that to various URIs. But what if you don't want to show certain people that data?
Right.
Don't have the mechanisms in most name servers or in any name servers, as far as I know, to do that sort of authorization at a very, very fine-grained level.
Is it even possible in principle?
I suppose if you had a way to, you know, map T-Sig keys to the organizations that you wanted to allow or deny, that it might be possible. But on a large scale, I don't think it's tenable.
It sounds like you're just on a slippery slope, basically.
Yeah, I really think that you don't have the tools. And again, I'm not an expert on enum, and so somebody who was might say, oh, well, that's all solved because we do X and Y. And
mm-hmm.
But from the DNS perspective, it seems like a very thorny problem.
Yeah, yeah. I know that you've been very concerned with security issues in recent years, and so for people who haven't followed closely what the story is there and actually, I'm one of them. I hear about it, but I haven't really studied it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could kind of summarize what's gone on in the last several years in terms of both the kinds of vulnerabilities that people have become more aware of and the kinds of approaches that have been taken to address them.
Sure. So we saw the first attack against DNS infrastructure in the wild way back in, 1997, I guess. And since then, we've seen a proliferation of these attacks. We've also seen name servers being used as agents in attacks, particularly type of distributed denial of service attack that's called a DNS amplification attack.
Mm-hmm.
And so a few organizations have sort of more systematically tried to map out the DNS infrastructure out on the Internet to get an idea of just how vulnerable it is, just how easy it is to use that infrastructure to attack others as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the news is not particularly good, as you might expect with a really substantial piece of distributed infrastructure like DNS. You have so many different name servers out there. In our most recent survey that we conducted with the Measurement Factory, we estimated that there are about 9 million name servers out there on the Internet. And we looked, to the extent that we could identify configuration problems, vulnerabilities, and so on, non-intrusively, without doing anything that would harm a remote name server or impair its operation. We did that, and we found, for example, that something like 53% of those name servers that we found have recursion open to just anybody.
For people who don't know, explain what that would mean.
Recursion is the function that allows a name server to go off and resolve domain names that are in zones that it's not itself authoritative for.
Mm-hmm.
So when, for example, you send your name server a recursive query for www.google.com, unless you work for Google, the name server that you use, the local name server, is probably not authoritative for google.com, so it has to, in the worst case, go off to the root name servers, follow a referral to the com name servers, follow a referral to the google.com name servers, and get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very important function. It's sort of what allows you to see the entire Internet namespace through the eyes of one name server, but it's not a function that should be offered to just anyone.
Mm-hmm.
The name server that you use should probably only be serving recursive queries that come from authorized group of users. So if you're in a corporate environment, that might be employees at the company, people whose IP addresses are on networks that the company owns. If
yep.
you're using an ISP's name server, that would be clients that are on networks that the ISP runs.
Right.
If a name server out there on the Internet accepts recursive queries from just anyone, that puts it at risk of, for example, cache poisoning attacks, denial of service attacks, and it also means that it's easy for a hacker to use that name server in a distributed denial of service attack against someone else.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that this has been a fairly common practice all along. Is it just that people are now being more scrupulous about investigating these kinds of vulnerabilities and bringing them to light and educating people about best practices?
Well, you know, I think it's been fairly recently that we saw this fate of these DNS amplification attacks, and that's part of what brought it to the fore.
Yeah.
You see the attacks, you go, oh, wow, well, how can we protect ourselves from these attacks? And one of the ways is to make sure that there aren't any name servers out there that permit recursive queries or that serve recursive queries from just anyone. And then you go out and figure out just what a substantial population that is.
Yeah.
You realize it's, you know, on 4.5 or 5 million name servers, and then you scurry around and look for other ways to solve the problem.
One of the interesting arguments that I heard recently, which is a claim on behalf of the resilience of the DNS system, was from Dan Geer, who, in his argument about the pernicious effects of monoculture, pointed out that the population of root servers in particular, but also the general population of DNS systems in the world, is extremely heterogeneous, and that that's a benefit.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. There are enough differences, actually, among individual versions of bind that you could almost think of, you know, say bind 8 and bind 9 as being pretty substantially different. Their code base is pretty substantially different.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact that within the root name server, and I think we have some, in addition to having both bind 8 and bind 9, we also have some NSD running now, which is a name server implementation, open source name server implementation that was done out of NLNet.
Hmm.
I think that really is helpful. We may not have actually seen the benefits of it yet, but hypothetically, I mean, you can conjure up in your mind the sorts of flood fill attacks that capitalize on some long latent vulnerability in lots of bind name servers that take them all out. And
mm-hmm.
at least today, that would not cripple the set of root name servers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what else has been on your radar screen in terms of these kinds of issues lately?
Well, there are lots and lots of aspects of vulnerabilities in DNS infrastructure that we've been looking at, you know, not just open recursive name servers, but also name servers that are open to doing zone transfers to anybody, zones for which all of the authoritative name servers are on the same network, that sort of thing. And we've tried to do as comprehensive survey of the Internet DNS infrastructure as we could
mm-hmm.
to give people kind of an overall look, a report card, if you will, measuring the health of the Internet's DNS infrastructure.
Right.
And we're going to continue doing that on an annual basis and publishing that. So that's, you know, that's been interesting.
How'd the grades come out?
Not pretty good.
Yeah.
Not grades that I ever would have wanted to get. They are, in some cases, improving slightly. We did the same survey last summer. We did it again this summer. And there were some areas that were improving a little bit. But, you know, still lots of problems. Because, you know, I think readers who, you know, look at results like that are likely to say, well, you know, that's fine, but my infrastructure is sound and need to worry about this. We also came out with a tool, a web-based tool that people can use to actually run very, very similar scans, actually a superset of scans that we ran against their own DNS infrastructure and determine the degree to which they are at risk.
And what is that called and where can it be found?
It's called the DNS Advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, it's actually named after me. I think it's called Cricket Lou's DNS Advisor.
Okay.
It's available. It's linked directly off of our website. You can get to it at, I think, dnsadvisor.infoblock.com.
Okay.
And we've also been looking at other new applications of DNS and enhancements to DNS. We've been talking about those. Enum is one of those, but also support for IPv6, for example, internationalized domain name, the new version of the DNS security extensions, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been going out. In fact, I just gave a talk yesterday educating people about that, sort of letting them know what's coming and you know, making our bets on which of them will be successful technology.
Clearly, DNS has been an astoundingly successful system over the years. Do you think we should be surprised by that? Some people are.
Oh, that it's been so successful?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I suppose there are sort of two ways to look at it. And one is that it's sort of a testimony to the scalability of DNS, how sort of well thought out it was in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
That it's been able to grow and adapt to accommodate today's internet. I think that's sort of undeniably the case. But on the other hand, you could also say that it's a little bit sad that nothing else has come along
to
plant some of those functions.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things, as we've talked about, that DNS really doesn't do all of that well, and we have to sort of shoehorn into the current infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. This kind of takes me back to that talk that Nelson Minor gave, and it makes me think that it is perhaps very difficult to change topologies, and that the kind of evolution that can occur within a topology is perhaps marginal and incremental, but it's very difficult to establish a new one because the implications are so far-reaching.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. I think that's quite true. There is, you know, there have been some interesting projects. There was one, I think, that came out of Cornell called CODONS, and I guess it's probably pronounced CODONS or something like that.
Hmm.
It's an application of distributed hash tables to DNS, and it kind of does away with some of the notions of authority, for example, that are built into traditional DNS, and gives you what's almost sort of a mesh of servers that communicate with each other, and then to the outside world, actually can present this sort of backwards compatible face,
where
they look like recursive name servers to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that has been interesting. Unfortunately, some of the developers of that system got embroiled in what looked like it had become just sort of a pissing match, where they said DNS is fundamentally broken in the fall. You know, all of the DNS experts rose up against them, and I'm not sure they really got a fair shake.
It's too bad people have to get all religious on this stuff, and we can't just kind of accommodate multiple perspectives at the same time and work with them. But, you know, that seems to be how things go.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, an interesting approach, though, to apply a new odd technology like distributed hash tables to the DNS problem, and it's nice to see that sort of thinking. So maybe there is the possibility that we could change some of the underlying structure of DNS
in an incremental way.
Yeah, and still preserve, for example, the protocol.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's a great thought. Well, excellent. Thanks again for, like I said, doing this on short notice, and enjoy Hawaii. I wouldn't mind being there right now myself.
Sure. Well, you're welcome, John.